One, two.
Dealing with a whole range of challenges when it comes to cost of living and various other aspects as well. Let's talk a bit more about Black Friday there with John Wilson and Andy. John, first of all, define yourself, please. Explain your role in this life. I mean, I'm often sort of about this, but John, share with us, what's your role in this particular wonderful thing?
Okay, well, I work for a wonderful company called Deputy, and we help companies manage shifts for their teams and help their teams manage flexibility with lives and livelihoods. And we do a fantastic piece of research every year called the State of Shift Work. And that's what we're here to talk about today. And I run Deputy here in the UK.
And Andy, of course, your connection?
I am the UK's first ever Doctor of Happiness. So I know that sounds a little bit weird in the world at the moment because the world isn't very happy. But however, what I did, I spent 12 years at Loughborough University researching a subject called positive psychology, which is essentially the science of happiness and the science of well-being. So it's like flipping psychology on its head, away from what's wrong with people to what's right with people, away from illness towards wellness. So, and it just so happens that my knowledge dovetails in exactly with what this project's all about.
Exactly. And as we know, when you are a doctor of happiness like Dr. Andy Cope, you can forget about 60 years of Doctor Who. This is the doctor we've been looking for, which is great.
Well, actually, mate, can we start with that? Because I think we need to acknowledge before we go into what this project even is. Actually, the world is in a difficult place right now. I've just turned 57. I cannot remember a worse 4 weeks or 5 weeks of news. And I think that the world is really challenging. And hats off to people who are still on their feet, still giving it their best shot, because it's exhausting and it's relentless. And that pertains to everybody, but particularly we want to talk today about people who work in shifts, shift workers.
Very true. Okay, let's turn to John. You head up, or basically deputy in the UK, as we said. We've heard there from Andy how challenges are actually there. Is it just a case of, I mean, we literally, the University of Lincoln, we literally had some thank you awards a couple of days ago, which were a nice
Okay.
motivating factor from that point of view. I celebrate
Fantastic.
my reward of merit, which is nice. But in terms of that, is it just a case of we forget we are so pressurized by work, shift work, and so on that we get caught up in this almost hamster-like wheel of never-endingness?
I think you probably nailed it there. And I think also when we talked about this a little bit off camera is, in the UK, we're more likely to talk about things that bad service or challenges that we've had, and we're less likely to highlight the positives. When we conducted this research, we asked people what would result in a more positive working conditions for you? And it was simply to be recognized for a job well done. A simple thanks, and those words, a simple thanks, came up a lot, which is why this campaign started. So, at simplethanks.org, you can use social media and say thanks for some great service that you've had from whoever was serving you coffee, or maybe you're shopping this weekend. It's a big retail weekend, and retail workers will be working almost 30% more time this weekend than they do normally. So everybody's stretched and flat out. And it's a great time just to actually pause and kind of say, our lives are made infinitely better by the interactions that we have every day. And I think when you get good service and something nice happens, don't be afraid. Say thanks.
Andy, the attitude of gratitude is a phrase that we've frequently used in the past. We might have used it in a previous item with yourself. Is it as simple as that? I mean, I was fascinated by this notion of the hyperdyadic effect, which sounds very, very complex.
It does.
I mean, can we break that down in terms of, is it
Please.
just a case of, as we've just heard from John there, just being nice and being kind and saying thank you?
Please, let's break it down. Yeah, I don't think we need big words. What we need is tangible stuff that actually works in real world that lifts the mood. The hyperdyadic effect essentially means that your emotions are contagious. So human beings are built to connect with other human beings emotionally. So, but the hyperdyadic thing is essentially a ripple effect. So what that means is you, when you're having a good day, that is really good for you. It's good for your health, creativity, vitality. But it also kind of leaks out of you and reaches 3 degrees of people removed from you. So if I'm having a good day, I've got a smile on my face, and then everybody that I meet will catch that positivity. Everybody they meet will catch their positivity, and everybody they meet will catch their positivity as well. So it's like, and if more people are grateful, thankful, happy, smiley, respectful, whatever you want to call it, kind of old-fashioned values almost. It's even sad that we have to have this conversation to remind people to be a nice human being. But if you do that, you create a ripple effect. That's the truth. And I don't think it's like trying to create a ripple. It's like a tsunami of positivity that can spread across the country, because you've got to wrestle control back from the negative side, I think the negative media, and try and create. We're trying to create this week, over this weekend, 1 million thank yous. So, and as John just said, it's really easy to go the other way. It's really easy to get bad service and vent your spleen on social media about how terrible everything is. But actually, good service, like, we forget to acknowledge it, we forget to say thank you. And if we can't give these people a pay rise, they are overworked, underpaid, underloved, what we can do is say thank you and mean it.
You've raised a really interesting point there, Andy, about social media, because clearly the algorithms that the likes of Meta, X, and so on, they work on, in a sense, the hate paradigm. Is that something we almost need to have a digital detox and actually say, okay, I mean, you use the phrase take back control, much associated with Dominic Cummings, of course, but let's not go there,
Yeah,
please.
sorry about that. I think there is an element of, I mean, social media, that's a different subject for another day. We could do a separate thing on that. But I do think that we are super busy doing the wrong things, things that don't make us happy. So we call it doom scrolling, don't they? When you know, when you've been scrolling on your phone for half an hour, ask yourself, how do you feel about that? And you're not going to feel invigorated and alive by it. You're going to feel drained. So we're too busy doing the wrong things. And I think getting busy, creating human connections, eye to eye contact, saying thank you, acknowledging good service, it's just a small thing that you can do that will have a huge impact on the people around you. In fact, play it the other way, right? I used to work in retail, and if I had an angry customer or a negative customer who's taking it out on me, that ruins my entire week. One customer ruins my entire week. And what this project is about is a simple thanks, is changing that narrative and making somebody's day instead of ruining it.
John, you've been listening to Andy wax lyrical there about the future. Are you encouraged? Are you positive? Or is it a case of I'm just going to do some more doom scrolling? I've had enough.
No, we're very positive. There's a great hashtag, a simple thanks, all one word. Let's get that trending. When we speak to shift workers, 80% of shift workers are most likely to be on minimum wage. So, like Andy said, they're not earning a lot of money. They love their job, though. Even though in the cost of living crisis, it's a challenge, difficult to make ends meet. They like doing what they're doing. They like interacting with the public. That's us. We can make that a little bit better. And I think when we all went through the pandemic, we realized just how valuable people in hospitality were, the people who delivered our packages, the people who cared for our relatives in hospitals and care homes. And I think, as we, inverted commas, get back to normal, sometimes forget just how valuable the contribution is here. And I guess our small way of trying to raise some awareness here is to pick the busiest weekend of the year, have a shift worker Sunday, a day dedicated to shift workers, and just say thanks.
Absolutely, or Dankeschön, or spasiba, or indeed merci. Neither of those will actually work, depending on the language.
Fantastic.
And it's great to see that you've actually tied this in with a 48-hour ceasefire in the Middle East. So that's good as well. That's another positive bit
That
of news
helps.
story to
That
actually
does
work
help.
through. Okay, let's have that hashtag again. I mean, much as Andy, I'd love to actually set a hashtag with hashtag hyperdyadic. I think we go for the simpler one.
Hashtag a simple thanks, and you can check out more on asimplethanks.org.
Fantastic. John Wilson, basically head of deputy in the UK and Doctor of Happiness, Dr. Andy Cope. Huge thanks. And inevitably, gentlemen, be happy.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks,
You
mate.
too. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so it's Black Friday. We've had the Thanksgiving scenario. We've got obviously Cyber Monday. We've got, of course, Christmas around the corner. How do we actually ensure that basically we can avoid family fallouts? Well, maybe you need to look at the scale of housework inequality. Yeah, so again, housework inequality. And to actually work our way through this, we're delighted to welcome back to the program somebody who's always got some very sage words of wisdom and advice, relationship coach Hayley Quinn. How are you, Hayley?
I'm good, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. So, Christmas, we know it's time of joy and peace and goodwill to all human beings, etc. But there are a number of feuds and, shall we say, hotspots or danger points or even flare points that can result when it comes to cooking, cleaning, and indeed spending. I mean, this research by Starling Bank, were you surprised or was it a case of, yeah, that kind of confirms my experience?
I would say it's definitely more on the side of confirms my experience. So, indeed, this new research from Starling shows that 60% of couples argue in the run-up to Christmas, and I actually don't find that surprising at all.
So, okay, allowing for that, and we always talk about communication and how communication is a vital part of the whole thing. We know that when emotions are running high, there are an awful lot of stress factors that are around as well, and we all want to kind of have the best Christmas ever. Do we overpressurize? Do we actually raise the standards too high so that either with ourselves or with our partner, we kind of tend to get into an area where inevitably it becomes a no-win situation?
Well, I do think you're right. There's a lot of extra stress. Well, I think there's a lot of stress and pressure anyway. Add in Christmas, and it's just another dimension. I think we live in times where people often are feeling quite financially overstretched. They're feeling like they're working long hours. They're feeling that when they get home, their domestic chore list is never ending. And now we have a whole other list of chores, which are all to do with Christmas. So this research by Starling is all about looking at how we can share the load more effectively, and because sort of inequality, as you said, in household labor. And you might be thinking, well, what's that? And it's essentially everything that you do that isn't your sort of paid employment. It's putting the dishwasher on, it's the washing, it's looking after the children, it's who's buying the Christmas presents, it's who's doing the car insurance. And I'm sure most people listening to this will be nodding their heads thinking, oh yeah, I've got quite a lot on that to-do list. What this research is aiming to do is to encourage people to use the Share the Load tool online to gain transparency around who is doing what in their relationship. So use the tool to log all of your tasks that you're doing, and then you can look at that with your partner and just figure out, really, is there a way that you'd prefer to be doing this? Do you feel that how you're sharing the load at the moment is unfair, or would you like to swap a task? Do you feel like you're fed up with being the one that's always responsible to be doing something and you want some extra support? So it's all about creating transparency around who's doing what in this often unseen and sort of underappreciated area of labor that we have to do in our lives.
Interesting to see that 44% of men reported contributing the most at home, but only 6% of women actually agreed with that.
Well,
That I thought was quite a significant and indeed pertinent point, especially when you've just been talking about transparency.
exactly. And you know, it's the same the other way around. Three quarters of women believe that they do the most tasks, and only 18% of their male partners agree. So we can see that it's often that I think people feel, whether they're man or woman or whatever form of relationship they're in, that they are contributing a lot. And I think when we get in that zone of we're, you know, concentrating on how much we are doing, it can be hard just to acknowledge and witness what our partner is contributing as well, particularly if some of those tasks, as I said, aren't as obvious as other ones. To give an example, it's sort of obvious when you're looking after the children, because if someone's a parent in a couple or a relationship, that feels that there's a one or two or more human beings that are being looked after. Researching insurance, which you have to do perhaps on your computer or tablet or laptop, it's not as obvious that you're contributing to the household in that way, but you are still absolutely doing something. So I guess by breaking down all of our chores, which are obvious or inobvious, and sort of tallying them up, it's about us again gaining appreciation for our partners for what they are bringing to the table.
Yeah, that makes sense. Actually, I'd say that researching insurance can be a lot more stressful than actually dealing with the children, but another line. In terms of the future, can it be made easier? Will this actual app actually help? Is it a case of we're just waiting for AI to effectively start coming up with virtual Hayley Quinns for every household, which we could actually
Oh, I
sort
thought you were going to
of
say
out?
like a robot cleaner or something.
No. I mean, you'd be providing advice and sage witticisms and such like.
Well, I think the main thing, you know, it always goes back to communication, doesn't it? And it's basically instead of inspecting our partner to intuitively understand everything that we're doing and what our needs are, it's about looking at it visually and understanding how those needs actually pan out in real life, then being, you know, so bold as to have a conversation about it. So instead of saying, oh, I'm really tired, and expecting our partner to just sort of guess what the right next step to take is, it's about being able to say, look, I know that you've got that big deadline at work, but would you be able to help me with X? Because I'm also feeling kind of overwhelmed with why. So it's about creating that transparency. And instead of sort of moaning, which is also valid at times, it's about being able to ask for what we need in a relationship, to not assume who does what in our relationships, and about getting clearer so that we can acknowledge what our partners bring to the table.
And that quite simply is why Hayley Quinn is one of the best relationship coaches you can actually have access. So there you go. Hayley, where can people actually find out more details about this Starling Bank research?
Oh, it's really good. If you just Google Share the Load, Starling Bank, it will pop right up. And it's a very, very simple, very intuitive tool. It takes no time at all, and it might save you a lot of disagreements over this festive period.
And where can people actually follow the wonderment that is your good self, Hayley Quinn?
I am also very Googleable. So if you Google Hayley Quinn or go to hayleyquinn.com.
There you go, Hayley. It's been a delight, as we knew it would be. Keep on keeping on. And if we don't speak beforehand, have a fantastic holiday season.
Oh, same to you, Alex.
Well, you may well have heard about that thing called Black Friday, and that's why if you were listening to certainly Hayley Quinn's advice there, it's for Christmas as well that she was talking about. Plus, of course, you had the other thoughts of the Professor of Happiness and how he needs to be convinced that we need to have much more happiness and dopamine in our lives and so on, which, of course, is generated by happiness. Well, of course, one of our guests today can guarantee the cure for happiness. It's simply going to a concert by Victoria Simmons and Chloe Rose. Is that not a good way of actually engendering happiness, would you not say, Anna Coscanell?
Yeah, it was. It was quite a dopamine shot for me.
Yeah, exactly. We can actually use that as a script in all sorts of ways. Somebody who's equally always happy and brings happiness to the whole program, even though I'm not sure how happy she'll be about Geert Wilders' recent election. But nevertheless, Fia van den Bogert, welcome to the program.
Is it okay?
Yeah, go Geert, go Geert. We're happy for you to be on board. Or when you say finally in Holland, in the Netherlands, we have got our version of Donald Trump.
The latter, yeah. I think we have our version of Donald Trump right now. Yeah. I'm not happy with
no.
it.
No. I can sense that. I can sense your pain, Fia. Don't worry.
I mean, a lot of people's pain here. And
Listen.
You can't blame one group for all of our problems, and he's done it. And he's convinced a lot of people. And we'll see.
Things could be much more challenging. You could be in Argentina. Oh, hang on a minute. They've also elected a friend of Donald Trump. obviously, we still are waiting the day when Richard Fitzwilliams will declare his intention to run for Parliament, to effectively sort of, you know, lead us into a brave new world, much as probably Napoleon actually had in mind when he started actually expanding his particular empire. Isn't that right, Richard?
Well, I mean, one has to bear in mind, of course, when one talks about Napoleon, one of the world's most controversial figures, there's no question about it.
He brought back slavery. I mean, that was a minor thing, surely.
He did indeed. There is a great deal to be said, both for and against Napoleon, who I overall regard as a megalomaniac, simply because he fought 61 battles. He didn't know when to stop. It's the charisma that Eitel Tracking Phoenix brings out tremendously well in this very controversial movie by Ridley Scott. There's no doubt about that. And it's important when one bears Napoleon and what subsequently he, if you like, achieved, to remember the chaos that he rose to power during. I mean, it's, of course, we remember the Ancien Regime, and indeed how corrupt that was and how divorced from the needs of the people and what happened to Louis, and also in the first scene of this. It's quite graphic. I have to say, I looked a little askance at one or two scenes, because we see Marie Antoinette being beheaded, and it is very dramatic. It's the right beginning, because what this film shows is how somebody as charismatic, as monstrous, if you like, as Napoleon could rise to power, the tactical and military genius, to be sure, but also, of course, there's a certain balance, because it concentrates partly on the military, partly on his love affair, no question that it was, with Josephine, who he divorces when she can't bear him an heir, but there's no doubt that there's chemistry between them, and it comes across very well. You've got an awesome epic here. Now, you will have heard, and I mean, I've just been listening to Andrew Roberts on Sky News launch a fierce broadside at it for having played fast and loose with a lot of history, which it does.
Richard, it's a movie. Ridley Scott is a movie director. I mean, when have movies ever played, you know, honest with respect to history? You change things around, you do it to suit the whole product. You know, I mean, Alien was not real. Does Andrew Scott realize that? That was a work of fiction. Likewise, Blade Runner. Likewise, Gladiator. These are works of fiction. Ridley Scott is a very good filmmaker.
Well, these are works of fiction. Of course, the point here is Napoleon was real. And there is no question.
And it was Marcus Aurelius, but that doesn't mean he was represented accurately in Gladiator.
He wasn't represented accurately either in Gladiator or in The Fall of the Roman Empire.
How do you know? Were you there? I'm quoting Ridley.
That is exactly Robert.
Didn't he say, get a life?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what happened with Marcus Aurelius, say, in The Fall of the Roman Empire, he's poisoned with an apple. In Gladiator, he's, the embrace that Commodus holds him in is a bit unrelenting.
With Joaquin Phoenix, of course, who is Napoleon.
In reality, Alex, he co-ruled with Commodus, I was disappointed to note, for a philosopher, and he died of plague. But don't let's dwell over much on facts. It's perfect.
In years to come, people will be saying that Geert Wilders was the most democratic person on the planet.
That who will?
Geert Wilders.
I do not think that will be the case. However, just remaining with Napoleon for a second, you've got to have a character. Fair enough, he appears at Marie Antoinette's beheading, and he didn't. Fair enough, he didn't open fire at a pyramid, and fair enough, he didn't actually lead any cavalry charges. So he did fight hand-to-hand at the siege of Toulon. But you've got to have a character, an actor, who could combine ferocious ambition, brutish manners, and a certain charisma with an ego that literally knows no boundaries at all.
Literally Geert Wilders.
Well, literally, one has to say, yes. I mean, there's some strange people popping up. Argentina's another one. But, you know, it's one of the film's strengths. Firstly, you've got an amazing visual style here. It's filmed in the saturated colour, and it gives it all a very, very grim realism. Then you've got battle sequences that are unbelievable. We see the Battle of Austerlitz, where Napoleon defeated the Russians and the Austrians, and that's superbly filmed. The filming is amazing. We see Waterloo. No question whatsoever that the film leaves out an awful lot. You could argue, for example, and I mean, it struck me when I first saw, goes through his entire career. He's in his mid-20s. Joaquin Phoenix is nearly 50. Yes, he does look a bit old. You could argue there's quite a lot of diplomatic maneuvering in the movie. A very good performance by Paul Reiser's Talleyrand, who was the Napoleon's equivalent of a foreign minister. Yes, one has to say, not a mention of, say, the battles of Trafalgar and the Nile, where the Royal Navy...
It's a historical movie. It's not meant to be a piece of absolutely historic accuracy.
I don't need, Alec, I do not need to be told that. The Crown, indeed.
If you want accuracy, go to Peter Morgan. That is absolutely spot on with every sense of the word.
Including ghosts. Yes, indeed he is. Now, I have to say that Napoleon swept me away because it evoked an era. It wasn't exactly what happened, and indeed vast amounts are obviously left out for the director's cut of 4 hours or 4.5 hours, depending what you believe. We may learn about Wellington's victories in Spain and the Peninsular War, which drained the French. Also, it's worthwhile remembering that at the end of this film, it lists some of the battles and casualties. One has to mention, or should mention, that, of course, if you look at the overall total killed or estimated to be killed in the Napoleonic Wars, you're going into millions. So, I mean, this was the man who, well, as I say, he couldn't stop. He led his army into Russia. I wasn't aware 600,000 men went in. Most of them, or a large number of them, were killed in the earliest or died in the early stages, simply because at that time,
That, Richard, is why it's sensible if you're the general not to actually lead from the front. You know, stay at the back and you've got a better chance of surviving.
Well, they simply couldn't supply an army that size then. There's an extraordinary scene where Moscow's set alight. They're very, very effective ritualistic scenes such as the coronation, which is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I've always viewed him as this megalomaniac like figure, whether or not you want to go into comparisons with Hitler and so forth. And the fact also there's no mention in the film, which there certainly should be, about his reforms, is another matter. But it is a riveting picture. Cinematically, for me, it works. The script is literate. You've got an excellent performance by Vanessa Kirby as Josephine, playing the part with a good deal of sensitivity. Yes, they're quite graphic sex scenes. Yes, to be sure, there is a lot of, superb, the handled action and use of CGI. It's got a variety of things which anyone who is interested in historical epics...
In other words, Richard, you'd like people to effectively not go to see this in the cinema, but wait until it comes to our streaming devices, watch it on television where you get the full 4.5 hours, as opposed to suffering from Ridley, as himself termed, numb bum syndrome.
Well, I see, as far as Ridley Scott's concerned, some of his comments about making the film, the fact historians can't talk about it because they weren't there. It has been pointed out that, of course, people did leave memoirs. But having said that, I mean, where there's a perverse way in which you're drawn to the figure, which you're meant to be, and then you look into the mirror and you wonder what aspect of your own personality perhaps is drawn to this.
Speak for yourself, Richard. I'm sure Thea, or indeed Anna, or indeed Sarah Huntley, have never actually felt the urge to actually invade Moscow, Russia, or indeed Spain, or England.
Not this morning, no.
No. Nice to see that Anna had that caveat in there, because it is obviously the Romanian view. Not this morning, but who knows what could happen by the afternoon.
Well, I mean, one of the aspects of this movie, it's a sense in larger than life, if you have vast cavalry charges. Admittedly, Napoleon didn't lead the cavalry, but I mean, you've got another era with scenes in palaces and salons, the lighting, the costumes, all of this. It's an epic achievement. I'm amazed that Ridley Scott, after The Last Duel, which is a very underrated movie.
He's only 85, Richard. He's only 85. He's got many more years yet.
I hope so, Alex, because we've got Gladiator 2 coming up.
Yeah. Let's move to Anna. Anna, is this a movie for yourself, or is it a case of, frankly, having experienced both Chloe Rose and Victoria Simmons in concert, there can be no greater performance that's left to see in the world?
Well, that was indeed a great performance, an amazing performance, and I encourage people to go on the Siren Radio website to listen again. But for sure, it is a must to watch these movies. And I also have a fact for people that will make them watch it even faster. The Lincoln Cathedral appears in the movie, as well as the Lincoln Choir.
Yeah.
And yeah. You see, I don't know, I think...
Richard deliberately omitted that because he censors anything to do with Lincoln, you see, whereas you and Anna have quite rightly turned around and said, yes, what about that historical fact, Mr. Fitzwilliams?
In what scene does it appear?
It appears at the beginning, partway through the film, in a short through a window. The director said of the choir, says he conducted the choir of around 15 boys and 15 men throughout the movie to sing. But the girls were not involved, as far as I know. The news appeared 1 hour ago, so I am not fully informed of what happened. But I know that there are a few shots at the beginning where you can see the cathedral.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Fia, does that make you nostalgic to return back to the British area, where, of course, until recently, we had a very well-balanced prime minister and probably friend of Geert Wilders? That would have been Mr. Johnson, or could have been Liz Truss. Who knows?
You don't know. I didn't know, actually. I watched a movie last night and I didn't notice. But now I want to watch it again.
People say that about Lincoln all the time, day in, day
yeah,
out.
I want to come back, yeah, always. No, but I mean, if you want to watch the movie for the history, I wouldn't recommend it, because it's just mainly action. But I do love the action scenes and the battles. I mean, his strategics was he was such a smart man, and he, I mean, he was a very good strategist. So
it's
just
so Moorish for him. You know, you have one battle, you fancy another one, a bit like Chinese in many ways. You know, you want to actually go on and on, keep on nom nom nomming away through the whole process.
Actually, won battles, and he won 54 of them, but not Waterloo.
No, but that was more of a massacre if you look at it now. But
Well, Waterloo, we remember the combined forces against him were England and or Britain and Prussia. And had he won, I mean, Napoleon's strategy, the numbers of individuals who'd been killed in the wars was such that France's, they were running out of manpower. There were far fewer French. And what he fatefully did was divide his force before the battle. 30,000 of his men were supposed to prevent the Prussians from joining up with Wellington, but they didn't know which way the Prussians would go, and it was a disaster. They're very, very good reenactions of Waterloo that you see in the film. There was a film in 1970 with Rod Steiger and Christopher Plummer called Waterloo, which was a very spectacular movie, rather many cliches in some of the dialogue, but it was a disaster financially. So Stanley Kubrick, who was going to produce his own Napoleon,
he never got round to it. He put it off and put it off and put it off and put it off until, of course, St. Ridley came along and sorted it.
Alex, until Steven Spielberg has got the script and is going to film another Napoleon, apparently.
Well, you know, when all said and done, I think it's one heck of a way to actually promote a Swedish band's number one hit from 1974. I got the feeling we won the war. I don't know. Sarah Huntley, now you're back from your cinematic duties or your movie routines. What are your own thoughts on life, the universe, and more? And are you going to just go and see Napoleon, or is it a case of, I don't have, you know, that sort of time to spend? You know, I've got too many acting things to do myself these days.
I'm so sorry, Alex. I was so looking forward to giving you a big hug and seeing you in person. And ironically, I haven't worked all year, and my agent gets me a job on that Saturday. So it was promoting different pantomimes, which are all about...
Anna appreciates the fact that just step by step, we basically sort of were losing more troops than Napoleon was losing in one of his battles, really, on the attendance last night. But it's okay. Those who were there were good. And you can, of course, listen again online. Carry on, Sarah.
I'm going to do that with, I have my chores today around the house. I'm looking forward to that. So I'm so sorry. And I'm afraid you haven't got away. I'm coming to visit. I'm afraid it's imminent. I will come up. But it
I'm
was
keeping my shades on just in case, because it is very sunny in Lincoln today, as Anna will obviously attest to.
Yeah. So actually, I've heard there's been a lot of publicity, some good, some bad, about this film. So I was intrigued to hear what Richard was saying. I think the poster does it for me, because to me, the way he's looking as Napoleon is kind of what Napoleon would personify to me. An interesting face, and there's a lot going on there. But it is a terribly long film, and I don't think, from what I've heard, I don't know, but historically it's not particularly correct.
History is just one system of beliefs replaced by another system of beliefs. You know, it's rewritten by the
books. One history with one bloody thing after another.
Exactly. You know, if it hadn't been for his boots, doubtless the Duke of Wellington would never have actually had his portrait put up in all sorts of ways, and we'd be all speaking French now. And some might say the world might be better for it. After all, William the Conqueror helped, didn't he?
Well, there's always Rupert Everett's very fine performance as Wellington. Very dashing. I commend it.
Yeah, I think it might be one that I wait till it's shown at home and I can have lots of cups of tea while I'm watching it.
Oh, but that's a disaster, Sarah. The reason is because it relies on these extraordinary reenactions, period reenactions, the chaos of the revolution when the terror, like Saturn devouring his own children, Robespierre and the similar go completely mad, the extraordinary scenes of the guillotine, and then the battle sequences, which are absolutely vast. You get this extraordinary sense of armies on the march, or the ritual of a coronation. It is larger than life, almost dangerously. So you do need to move away from that small screen and see it on an IMAX.
No,
Richard. All right, yes, okay. So I take your point, Richard. So I take back what I said, and I
Thank you. I get it now.
Yeah, so, you might listen to Richard. Ridley's quite happy for you to wait and watch it on the small screen. He doesn't mind.
No. To gain the full experience of this, I need to commit fully in the big screen.
Just use your laptop and sit very close to it. Same thing.
And I have one very fun fact about the film. It's 158 minutes, which is also how tall Napoleon was.
Exactly. Again.
But actually, he wasn't. And it also, one more fun fact, and that is also not true, apparently, but it's English propaganda that always said that he was a very small man, but in real life, he was actually an average-sized man. So
yeah, there we are, precisely.
Yeah, so now I hope I've convinced you.
and presumably we're talking 158, are we talking centimetres here? Or are we talking inches? Yeah.
No, centimetres.
Centimetres, right. Because it's critical, obviously, for you know, the decimal versus the imperial measurement in terms of how tall l'empereur really was, basically. But important facts, sir. Good. Well, I mean, once again, as you can tell, Richard, both Anna from Romania and Fia from the Netherlands, clear to actually sort of, you know, just sort some of those key facts out. I'm not sure whether either of them have actually been to Saltburn. Actually, Sarah, have you ever been to Saltburn by the sea?
Yes, I have, because it's quite near where the studio is, isn't it?
Saltburn. Well, one of our studios used to be there, yes, Middlesbrough, that's right.
Yeah, Saltburn-on-Sea, yeah.
Anyway, nothing to do with respect to Saltburn, the movie, but is this one which is going to eviscerate the world, Richard, in terms that you can only begin to allude to in your review of Saltburn?
Yeah, no, you're right here, Alex, because so far as its plot, the best way of discovering it and enjoying it to the full is to know, as I did, very little about it. I mean, director and writer Emerald Fennell, she has a reputation for being deliciously subversive, and she lives up to that here. Her acclaimed first feature was Promising Young Woman. Behaviour of its central character, the way it dissected the predatory patriarchy was extremely effective. And here you've got her insightful and, I would say, seemingly boundless imagination is brought to a gothic story of obsessive love. What we see is a hierarchical system that helps define the image of a nation being subverted, and the plot is superficially beguiling. You might think you were traveling into another zone like Bride's Head, and it unravels in very unexpected ways. So, firstly, it features Oxford and a stately home, and the English fascination with class is at its centre. And here we have the fortunes of a working-class outsider, Oliver Quick, played by Barry Keoghan, who is infatuated with the rich aristocratic Felix Catton, played by Jacob Elordi, when they're both students at Oxford. They become friends, and he asks Oliver to stay at the family home of Saltburn during a sultry summer. Well, it's certainly a movie that you will not forget if you dip into the world, the effortless upper-class world of Sir James and Lady Catton. Richard E. Grant plays Sir James. Rosamund Pike is Elspeth, Lady Catton. Glorious portraits of eccentricity. And also there is a cousin, Farley, played by Archie Medekwe. And we have Felix's sister, Venetia, played by Alison Oliver. Now, how does Oliver ingratiate himself with a group of people who he starts envying? Now, what happens? This is what the film poses questions. What happens if you like a particular lifestyle? It's way beyond you. You're never going to get it, or you're going to succeed in even being part of the
outside. You need to make peace with your inner soul and harmonize the disharmony, Richard. It's quite simple. You've studied Zen.
I don't think that's quite what happens in this film, Alex, but
it would be a lot shorter if it was, though.
Without giving away any spoilers, it's a very seductive film. It's a very wicked movie. It's divinely decadent in many ways. It's a sort of sexy fantasy world. And it could be a dangerous world, too. You've got the gleaming spires of Oxford. You've got the magnificence of Saltburn, especially the hedonistic summer, the musical score. I mean, the Buckley...
Built on the back of the people who actually put the iron and steel industry in place with respect to Middlesbrough. That's the whole sequence of Saltburn. Before that, it was a smuggler's haven.
Well, I can only quote the butler, who commands that no spoilers be revealed in the production notes. So, you didn't ask about the score of Napoleon, and I'd say 8 out of 10 for Napoleon, and for Saltburn, I would also say 8 out of 10.
Anna, Saltburn, is it a place where you feel, having visited Coventry several times and learned to love Coventry, especially the Festival of Diwali there, is Saltburn going to be on the Romanian tourist list in terms of when I'm actually in the UK?
Yes, most definitely. But just like all the other places, it's going to be after I am able to get a job.
Fia, I know you managed to do some of the journeys across the British Isles when you were here. Is it a case of Saltburn might be for you, or is it more a case of, frankly, with Geert Wilders in power in the Netherlands, any place out of the country is going to be good for me in the next few years?
I mean, exactly that, definitely. But I also need to do a road trip through England, so, and I still need to come back to Lincoln, so I need to add it to my list, apparently.
What about the movie, though? Is this one for you? Are you into divinely decadent scenarios? Surely not.
I'm not sure. I was quite confused by the trailer. I wasn't completely sure, but like, where are we going with this movie?
Well, the thing is, I may just say that the whole point, of course, is that you don't know a great deal about the path that you're going to be taking when you're watching this movie beforehand. Very, very good performances, by the way, of everybody involved, including Jacob Elordi and Barry Keoghan. So, you know, it's a mystery path where the divine decadence, perhaps the dangers await you.
Okay. So I guess I should watch it.
Sarah Huntley, one for yourself, or again, looking at the specific running time and the scenario of Saltburn in general, do you feel as though Saltburn and Oxford in the same movie, how can they possibly pack that into a couple of hours of running time?
Well, I think I would go and see this because my daughter went to see it on Friday night and rang me up and went, "Oh my God, Mum, I couldn't have watched that with you." And I thought, oh, that immediately makes me want to go and see it. So, yeah, I'd like to go and see Saltburn.
Personally, I'm amazed Richard's parents don't come down and actually sort of pop him on the shoulder and himself and say, "Richard, what are you doing?" I mean, it's just shocking, all this material that's happening there. In the same way as Princess Diana would actually return as a poltergeist or an ethereal form, just to kind of keep her eye on what's happening. There really isn't much time to actually go through the crown, and it's kind of, I know the line that Richard would like to go. You may have actually seen his eloquent review that he actually he put together. I think, was it for the BBC? I think it was the BBC that you sent me the link for that. Obviously, the BBC these days, they have no shame. They'll shamelessly promote any organisation other than their own. But still, what the hey? That's what happens when you have Russell T. Davies back in charge of Doctor Who. So, I mean, have you been watching The Crown, Sarah? Is it something you can add to ahead of next week? Or is it a case of, frankly, I don't know.
I did watch the first series of The Crown, but it's been a bit busy, actually, because I've actually been working on schoolwork. The one I really want to go and see, which I've heard quite a lot about this week, is the Bernstein film. I think
that's what we will be discussing that next week. I've seen it.
With the prosthetic nose, without the prosthetic nose, who knows what could happen on that one. Okay, Fia, The Crown, is it something which you're looking forward to analysing, or is it a case of until those British people and their royals learn to cycle in the way that royals really should cycle when they're going around on trips, witness the Netherlands, frankly, I have no interest whatsoever.
Well, I mean, they should definitely learn to cycle because it's the best way to transport. Yeah, but
if King Charles is going to COP28, he should be on his bike. That's all I can say.
Definitely, yeah. No.
Okay.
I mean, I watched the final one, and I mean, we could. I'm interested to hear everyone's opinion.
It's a cliffhanger ending, obviously, because we know that Richard needs more than just 2 or 3 minutes to really actually give vent to this particular side of things. So I'm deliberately filling in the time in betwixt times. Anna, is this something which you feel the Crown, have you watched any of the previous series? Is it a case of, well, once again, in Romania, we knew what was happening. We just impaled them on sticks. Look at Vlad.
I have started watching it when you sent me the first email with the run through. So right now I'm still at the first season, but I do plan on watching it further.
Well, I mean, that's torture personified. I would honestly recommend you jump straight to season 5 or season 6.
No, I have never done this in my life. I have never skipped.
You should definitely watch the first season.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah, the first season actually shows what the rest of it could have been like.
Given its history, and that basically, as we've already discussed, it really needed Ridley Scott's hand of accuracy to really give it a certain flavour that would work. Anyway, for the moment, to Anna Koskinen, to Fia Vandenberger, to Sarah Huntley, and to Richard Fitzwilliams, many thanks indeed. And as ever, as we head off into the wide blue yonder, keep watching those movies. A few years ago, there were banks that made a great play of the fact that you can do your bank charge details and so on and monitor your account 2 a.m. in the morning, 3 a.m. in the morning, 4 a.m. in the morning. This may not be a good idea, as indeed we're going to find out in terms of your mindset might not be at the best for actually dealing with number crunching and so on. And who's going to actually help us with this? Well, somebody who's not your typical financial expert. She has a dynamic approach to personal finance. She's obviously the founder of the widely acclaimed platform Pennies to Pounds. It's the fabulous Kia Commodore. How are you, Kia?
I'm good, Alex. How are you?
I'm okay. Now, again, this seems to be almost from the Department of Common Sense that you don't want to be half asleep when you're trying to make key financial decisions. But is it as simple as that? Is this the research that effectively is suggesting that, you know, maybe people are kind of making decisions when they're not fully balanced and ready to do so?
Yes, I think, as you said, it may seem, you know, common knowledge, of course not. But if you take the average person, you know, you go to work, maybe you've got kids, maybe you've come from the gym, you've got other things to do. So when you get back home and you're drained and you're tired and you think about your finances, you don't really have the mental brain capacity to, you know, be in the right headset to manage your finances. And if we couple that with, there's so much financial jargon out there with finances, financial providers are always speaking these big words, and 31% of people think that, you know, there's just so much that's not, you're not able to understand. A good example of this is the autumn statement that we saw yesterday. There was so much information that a lot of consumers should know, but was hard to understand because of the jargon. So what we're doing, I'm partnering with Wise, to get people to rethink how they look at their finances, because we work so hard for our money that we need to make sure our money's working as hard as it can for us. And often it's not. It's sat there earning low or no interest. And this is what we like to call lazy money. So we're trying to put an end to that, an end to lazy money.
Okay, sounds great, but I can already hear people saying, yeah, that's the problem with capitalism, though. You're trying to make all sorts of other challenges from that point of view. Is there a way, without you becoming the next Chancellor of the Exchequer, which would be my vote personally, any way to start addressing this and provide some practical solutions for people who maybe because of family circumstances or whatever, find themselves actually too fatigued to think clearly?
Absolutely. So I think when it comes to assessing your finances, I like to allocate either one day a week or one day a month is more than enough to focus in on your finances. So this could be a day during the day where you say, right, this is the 1 hour I've carved out to focus on my finances. Hopefully at that point you should have some more energy. You're not going to be completely fatigued as you may do after work, but you can focus yourself completely on managing your finances. Well, if we look at where your money's stored, you know, a lot of people have money in just savings accounts and don't know how much return or interest they're earning. So that can wildly vary. You know, one interest, one savings account could give you interest of 4.1%, whereas another could only give you a measly 1.6%. So it's so important to see where your money's stored and how much return are you going to get on that money. But like I said, the biggest thing is just to carve out some time towards your finances. And I think another one is any big financial decisions you need to make. So I don't know, maybe you need to remortgage your house and you've got to go through those documents. Don't do them when you're tired. Do the smaller things. Do you check in up on your savings accounts? Do you check in your credit score? Because that doesn't need too much brain power. But anything that's really important, try your best not to do it when you are extremely fatigued, because you need to make sure you're at your sharpest to go through those.
From your perspective, was the autumn statement simply a last gasp attempt to hang on to power, or is it a case of, well, there are some lines there that could be beneficial to all?
That's a really big question. I think there are some things that I think a lot of consumers can take from that. You know, we've seen an increase in the state pension, we've seen an increase in benefits and the national living wage. But again, I think that there is a lot that was missed. So for the average consumer, it's a small win, but I think there was a lot more that could have been done.
And looking at the ever-changing world in which we live in with respect to technology and use of technology, etc., what would you say is the most important message to convey to our listener here, whether they're a student, whether they're a postgraduate, whether they're a hard-pressed worker at home dealing with all sorts of lifestyle challenges? What would you say is the best takeaway?
I think the biggest takeaway here is, regardless of what point you are in your life with your finances, is just to make sure that your money is working as hard as it can for you. So any money that you have in savings, have a look and see what's the interest rate. Am I going to get a good interest rate? Because some savings accounts still have like a 0.25%, which is next to nothing. And your money's sitting there meant to be working for you. So we want to put an end to lazy money and making sure that your money is in the best places that it can be to work and grow for you.
And that's exactly why you've been featured in The Guardian, The Financial Times, BBC Five Live and more in terms of your tireless, tireless attempts to demystify personal finance. A reminder, of course, the podcast our platform is Pennies to Pans. What's the best way, Kia, that we can find out more about what you're doing and indeed discuss more of the things we've covered today?
Of course. So if you want to hear more savings tips, then make sure you visit wise.com/endlazymoney, where I've got my savings guide there on how some more tips and tricks to manage your money. And if you want to find me, that's Pennies to Pounds on all platforms, where, as you mentioned, I aim to demystify personal finance and hopefully remove all the jargon so you can understand it a lot better for yourself.
Kia Commodore, a financial expert extraordinaire. Many thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you, Alex.